British unions say the current rail strikes could mark the start of a, quote, summer of discontent, with more workers heading for industrial action amid rising inflation. Russian forces pushing deeper into Donbass after they capture Ukraine's Tashkivka village near the twin cities of Severodonetsk and Lysychansk, the site of fierce fighting. The leader of France's Conservative Party says arrogant Emmanuel Macron must make compromises after losing control of Parliament. This is World News. I'm Behrouz Najaf. You're welcome. Tens of thousands of railway workers in Britain are walking off their jobs, bringing rail transport nationwide to a standstill. Some 50,000 Britons are refusing to work at the biggest strike in more than three decades. Train services will also be canceled on Thursday and Saturday. Strikers protesting their low wages as inflation has pushed 10%. Last year, talks over the workers' demands have failed to break the impasse. London's Underground also remains shut due to a separate strike causing commuter chaos. The opposition Labour Party is criticizing the government to Prime Minister Boris Johnson for failing to resolve the dispute. Johnson has reacted to the strikes, calling them wrong and unnecessary.
Good morning. I want to say something about the rail strikes that are today causing significant disruption and inconvenience up and down the country, making it more difficult for people to get to work, risking people's appointments, making it more difficult for kids to sit exams, all sorts of unnecessary aggravation this is going to cause. And I want to emphasise to everybody this morning why I think those strikes are so wrong and so unnecessary.
Johnson also warned that the strike would harm businesses that are still recovering from the coronavirus pandemic. The strike action has already caused major disruption, leaving the stations deserted. But a strike leader saying the campaign will run for as long as necessary. The government is facing pressure over its economic policies as the cost of living crisis is pushing millions to the brink. Unions have spoken of what they call a summer of discontent, involving more strikes by teachers and medics, among other workers in different sectors. Saeed Khurizan, London, has joined us for the details on the rail strike in the UK.
The government is saying that the rail network has to achieve what they call financial sustainability. That has meant potentially, from the standpoint of the RMT, the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, which some would say is a militant union, but has a lot of clout, has a lot of power, would lead to the loss of several hundred jobs. And that's what they're trying to prevent by staging this strike today and in the coming days. The argument on the part of the government is that they have to achieve financial sustainability. They had to be bailed out post-pandemic because of the impact the pandemic had, and the 25% drop in ticket purchases by commuters. At the same time, wages have been suppressed to control inflation that has been impacted by a long list of things, from Brexit to the pandemic to the ongoing military conflict in Ukraine. So we're going to see this in the coming days as people continue to experience travel misery as a result of these strikes. And this is not the first one. This itself is the fourth in the year, and we're going to see similar action happening in the coming days by teachers, by nurses, generally NHS workers and staff, as we go ahead in the coming weeks and months.
Now, Russia warning NATO member Lithuania of serious negative consequences in case it refuses to lift a recently announced ban on rail transit of goods to Russia's Kaliningrad region. Moscow has promised to defend its national interests and summon the EU ambassador over the ban. Lithuania says the ban is in line with the bloc sanctions over Russia's offensive in Ukraine. The war, which began nearly 4 months ago, is now focusing on Ukraine's eastern Donbass region. Russian troops are going deeper there by taking two more towns. To the southwest, Russia has hit an airfield near the city of Odessa with missiles. It says the strikes were in response to Ukraine's Monday attack on its gas production platforms in the Black Sea. Now, more Ukraine news. The Kremlin says the two Americans who were caught fighting Russian forces in Ukraine have committed crimes and will have to be punished. Spokesman Dmitry Peskov said two were endangering Russian lives by firing it and shelling military personnel. According to Peskov, Russia cannot guarantee they won't face the death penalty. He says the nature of their crimes will be investigated. These are the first official comments from Moscow about the two Americans after the U.S. The department said it had seen reports of their seizure. Both captives are reportedly U.S. military veterans. Earlier, a Russian-banked court sentenced two Britons to death for fighting as mercenaries alongside the Ukrainian army. Johnny Miller provides us with a wider picture of foreign nationals who are caught fighting alongside the Ukrainian army against Russia.
Well, there's thousands of foreign fighters fighting for the Ukrainian army. Russia calls them mercenaries. A lot of Brits, a lot of Americans particularly. So it was only a matter of time until some Americans got captured. So we'll have to wait and find, to see their fate. There's fears that they could be sentenced to the death penalty, just like, as you say, two British fighters who are fighting for Ukraine. Now, Russia, the West is claiming that they should be treated as POWs, but pro-Russian forces say that, according to the Geneva Conventions, they should be treated as mercenaries, and therefore they're allowed to be tried in criminal courts. So that's very much the difference. Russia is, and the DPR have captured thousands of Ukrainian soldiers. There's evidence to suggest they are being treated reasonably well. But these Americans and Brits are a different story. So I have seen evidence that the two British soldiers who were sentenced to death, there's evidence to suggest that the Russians are trying to get them swapped for some high-profile prisoners that the Ukraine have, particularly the politician Medvedchuk, who is a high-profile pro-Russian Ukrainian detainee in Ukraine. And there's evidence to suggest that the Russians are trying to swap the Brits for high-profile prisoners, but there hasn't been any swapping there. But this is ultimately what the sentence they will get will be largely political. Two Americans captured by the pro-Russians or the Russians is clearly a high-profile negotiating tool for them.
The United States and Russia extended a crucial nuclear arms control treaty known as the New START until 2026, and that after President Joe Biden took the helm. But there are worries whether the world's biggest possessors of nukes would be able to extend their last remaining nuclear treaty. We've discussed that issue further in our news review program a short time ago.
A top Russian official says holding nuclear arms reduction talks with the U.S. is pointless, suggesting that Moscow should wait until Americans come forth and beg for negotiations. The former president and current deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, believes that there is no need to negotiate nuclear disarmaments with the U.S. yet, because it is bad for Russia. Medvedev says that Washington and Moscow don't have any relations now, and therefore everything is, in his own words, a dead zone. As Russia's President Medvedev signed the New START Treaty in 2010 with then U.S. President Barack Obama. The treaty was extended in 2021 for 5 years, but fears of a renewed arms race are now on the rise amid critically sour relations over the war in Ukraine. Russia and the U.S. are the world's biggest nuclear powers. They control about 90% of the global atomic arsenal. Fred Weir is a journalist and political commentator who joins us from Moscow. We also have Greg Simmons, who's an author and researcher, joining us from Uppsala. Welcome to you both. So let me first start with our guest there from Moscow, Fred Weir. When Russia says that the U.S. should come begging for having talks on this, I believe it's the fact that they don't have relations with the U.S., even though they may be interested, obviously, in this, and that is why they are saying that. Is that correct?
Well, I don't know. I'm one of those people who would say that nuclear arms control talks should be held on any given day, regardless of what else is going on. But it is a fact that there is virtually no communication between the two sides, and hasn't been for some time. It's just as bad as it could be in that respect. The Americans are acting in ways the Russians regard as extremely hostile in other areas. And one of the things, if to make sense of this from my own perspective, it is that the Russians have consistently throughout this war, it's now almost four months, they have stood up their nuclear deterrent, pointed to it, and said, we have this. Their purpose in doing that is to deter NATO from getting directly involved in the Ukraine conflict. So I can only see this as part of that. We're not talking about reductions or controls on nuclear weapons as long as this other stuff is going on. They're just underlining it to highlight this aspect of this overall crisis.
Well, if we were to take a look at the way that it seems like Russia is reacting to the whole issue, Greg Simmons, not to say that they're antagonizing the U.S., but basically they're saying when they're being treated the way that they have been by the U.S., along with its allies, but mainly the U.S., then even talking about it is useless. Of course, what Fred Weir says there is very important, and that is the fact that they just want to make sure on the possession that they are showing that to the U.S. So obviously for this not to be used.
Yeah, well, I mean, what Fred Weir says, it makes absolutely perfect sense. And, I mean, I agree fully. One should also take into account the rather checkered history of U.S. negotiations. I mean, Iran knows what the U.S. word is worth, or what an agreement is worth with the JCPOA. I mean, the United States has also been withdrawing from numerous arms control treaties which it has signed, or not renewing them. So, I mean, it has this history of bad faith negotiations.
Great. Let's take a listen to some of the online posts on this as reflected through social media, and we'll get right back to the conversation. Our first post, a dimension of American commitment to nuclear non-proliferation since the early 1960s, is that the spread of nuclear weapons triggers regional arms races and crisis instability that makes it very difficult for the global hegemon to respond in places and times of his choosing. With each new arms shipment, it is increasingly impossible to deny that the war being waged in Ukraine is a direct conflict between NATO and Russia, pitting the world's two most powerful nuclear arsenals in a standoff that is spiraling out of control. I'm looking at another comment here, Greg Simmons, that says that the Russians don't need to use nuclear weapons, and then he says they were smart enough to invent conventional weapons like Sarmat. I'm not too sure what that is, but it says the nuclear danger is coming from the U.S., not from Russia. When you take a look at the U.S., it is currently, and from years ago, in the middle, or maybe in the beginning, of a nuclear arms renovation to the tune of $2 trillion. So what is all this talk, anyways, about the reduction when this is happening? Maybe I'm not appropriating that renovation properly, but also the fact that they have pulled out of nuclear treaties. So what is the U.S. direction or incentive on this?
No, I mean, all of those things you point to, I mean, indicate that the U.S. is in the process of rearming and, as you say, upgrading its nuclear capability. So, and given the fact that they've engaged in bad faith negotiations in the past, I mean, it would be rather foolhardy for someone to take their word at face value, because all of these different things which we've just discussed now. I mean, the fact is that also, I mean, while we stress what Russia is doing with the nuclear grandstanding, I mean, there's been the threat of tactical nuclear weapon use from the U.S. side with reference to this Ukraine conflict. So, I mean, both sides are doing it. That's... I mean, one, can, like Fred, I would hope that mankind is not stupid enough to go down the same, road that will lead to a situation even worse than the 1962 Cuba missile crisis, but given the state of things at the moment, the lack of communication, this open hostility towards each other, and this escalating threat of force. I mean, one can never rule out inadvertent or misplaced, stupid use of force, which will escalate to that point.
Thank you very much for that. We do appreciate it. That is Greg Simmons, who spoke to us from Uppsala, author and researcher. And Fred Weir, thank you so much, journalist and political commentator from Moscow. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Thanks for tuning in.
All right, moving on. Political gridlock in France as President Emmanuel Macron and his allies remain in dilemma after failing to muster absolute majority in parliament. An opposition leader has dismissed any kind of coalition with Macron's camp.
We campaigned in the opposition against Macron's majority, against his government, and we remain in the opposition in a determined but responsible manner. Never will we block institutions, but it's out of the question to enter into a logic of a pact or coalition, to participate in anything of this nature.
Well, the official, however, said there is room for a case-by-case deals. He added, however, that it's only up to Macron to make his step in their direction and take their suggestions on board. Hours before the meeting, the leader of the Republican Party had described Macron as an arrogant who's calling for help. The president has just held talks with opposition leaders to persuade him to rally behind him. A potential coalition would enable the president to push through legislative reforms during his second term. The result of Sunday's election has dealt a blow to Macron's future agenda he had promised during the campaign. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ocean of dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
Ya man bada'a khalqi wa dhikri wa tarbiyati wa birri wa taghdiyati habni libtida'i karamak wa salif birrik bi ya ilahi wa sayyidi wa rabbi أتراك معذبي بنارك بعد توحيدك وبعد من طوى علي قلبي من معرفتك ولهج به لساني من ذكرك واعتقده ضميري من حبك وبعد صدق اعترافي ودعائي
Brothers and sisters, we were discussing the excerpt of the Kumail supplication, in which Imam Ali alayhi salam states, Ya ilahi wa sayyidi wa rabbi, O Allah, my master and my lord, aturaka mu'adhibi binarika ba'da tawhidik, can you be seen tormenting me with your fire after I have professed to your oneness? وَبَعْدَ مَنْ طَاعَ عَلَيْهِ قَلْبِي مِنْ مَعْرِفَتِكَ After your cognition my heart has embraced. In the previous episodes, we tried to discuss the different aspects of monotheism, specifically its practical aspect. Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, who conceived the reality of things, has offered the prerequisite for knowing Allah and worshipping Him in various sermons of his Nahjul Balagha. For example, he states, أَوَّلُ الدِّينِ مَعْرِفَتُهُ وَكَمَالُ مَعْرِفَتِهِ التَّصْدِيقُ بِهِ وَكَمَالُ التَّصْدِيقِ بِهِ تَوْحِيدُهُ وَكَمَالُ تَوْحِيدِهِ الْإِخْلَاصُ لَهُ وَكَمَالُ الْإِخْلَاصِ لَهُ نَفْيُ الصِّفَاتِ عَنْهُ The beginning of religion is knowing him. And the perfection of this knowledge is belief in him. The final point of this belief is believing in His oneness, and the purpose of this belief is sincerity toward Him. And what is the end point of this sincerity? Denying false features attributed to Him. Imam Ali alayhi salam continues and discusses that since every attribute is different from what it describes and vice versa, so anyone who describes Allah with an attribute has related Him to something. And if one relates Allah to something, he has considered Allah as two. And if he considers Allah as two, has considered Him as having aspects. And at the end of this part, Imam Ali alayhi salam states, He is eternal. Nothing has existed before Him, and He has experienced no non-existence. He is with everything, without being related to it. He is different from everything, without being separate from it. He is the creator of beings, without having a movement, and without needing any means. He is seeing, without needing a view of His creatures. He is one, because He has never had a match to befriend it and fear without it.
Oh my God, my Master, my Lord, and my Nourisher. Will you see me punished with the fire kindled by you, despite my belief in your unity? And despite the fact that my heart has been filled with knowledge of you, and when my tongue has repeatedly praised you, and my conscience has acknowledged your love, and despite my sincere confessions and my humble begging submissively made to your divinity, no, indeed you are far too kind and generous to destroy one you nourished and supported, or to drive away from yourself one you have kept under your protection.
Thank you, Allah, that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God speaks with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So, dear listeners, this is the importance of recognition of Allah, and the first of all things is recognizing Him as one, monotheism and oneness. And interestingly, one of the most significant requisites for the acceptance of prayer is the knowledge of Allah and the belief in His absolute power and strength in actualizing what the servants ask Him. Imam Ali alayhi salam, in another sermon, states, Alhamdulillahi alladhi la tudrikuhu shawahid wa la tahwihi al-mashahid. Praise be to Allah. He is such that senses cannot perceive Him. Place cannot contain Him. Wa la tarahu an-nawadhir. Eyes cannot see Him. La tahjubuhu as-sawatir. Veils cannot cover Him. Ad-dalli ala qidamihi bihuduthi khalqih. He proves His eternity by coming into existence of His creation. وَبِحُدُوثِ خَلْقِهِ عَلَى وُجُودِهِ. And also by originating His creation, He proves His existence. وَبِأَشْبَاهِهِمْ عَلَى أَنْ لَا شَبَهَ لَهِ. And by their mutual similarity, He proves that there is nothing similar to Him. He is true in His promise. الَّذِي صَدَقَ فِي مِعَادِهِ وَارْتَفَعَ عَنْ ذُلْمِ عِبَادِهِ. He is too high to be unjust to His creatures. He stands by equity among His creation and practices justice over them in His commands. وَقَامَ بِالْقِسْطِ فِي خَلْقِهِ وَعَدَلَ عَلَيْهِمْ فِي حُكْمِهِ. And at the end, Imam Ali alayhi salam states, بَلْ كَبُرَ شَأْنًا وَعَظُمَ سُلْطَانًا. He is big in His position and great in authority. So, the one who receives the belief in Allah's oneness from the Holy Quran, from the traditions, from the prophets and the imams and other sincere believers maybe, performs the obligatory deeds, avoids wrongdoing, and denies any deity but Allah. And in this sense, he is a real monotheist and he would be rescued. He would be granted great reward and he will be given sustenance from Allah both in this world and hereafter. The Prophet of Islam sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam has stated in this regard, خَيْرُ الْعِبَادَةِ قَوْلُ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهِ. The best worship is confessing to Allah's oneness by saying there is no God but Allah. There are many traditions upon the importance of stating this sentence, La ilaha illallah, and our traditions are replete with the different awards being given to the one who recites this La ilaha illallah. We will, God willing, talk about some of them later on. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye. Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah. Ya Allah, ya Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you by my side. I wish to be close, close to you through half my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah,
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has lambasted the West, stressing that the so-called Golden Billion countries still pretend that they are superior and consider other countries to be their colonies. He, however, stated that the West's ruling elites live in a dream world and refuse to see global changes. Putin also accused Western countries of deliberately undermining the foundations of international order to satisfy their geopolitical illusions.
As I think Putin's legacy will be in ushering in the end of American hegemony and the start of a unipolar world, helped in no small part by President Xi Jinping of China. The end of American hegemony will be mourned by a very small clique of nations that call themselves the international community. In reality, the international community is America and its client states. China, Russia, India, and much of the Islamic world don't take part in the shared narrative that is suggested by the term of the international community.
The Russian president stated that over the past decades, new powerful centers have been formed on the planet and are growing. He added that each of these countries has developed its own systems and also stressed that they have the right to protect themselves to ensure their national sovereignty.
It's obvious that the rules, the essence of the new world order, will be set by strong sovereign states which do not move along the trajectory drawn by somebody else. Only strong sovereign states can say their word in this emerging world order. Otherwise, they're doomed to become or remain rightless colonies.
Moreover, the Russian president said that the European Union has completely lost its political sovereignty, and its bureaucratic elites are dancing to someone else's tune, accepting whatever they are told from above, causing harm to their population and their economy. Putin slammed the EU's decision to impose sanctions on Russia as not well thought out, stating that the bloc's policies have delivered a serious blow to their own economies. The Russian leader says Western nations sought to use sanctions to crush the Russian economy by destroying logistics chains and hitting the Russian industry, finance, and living standards, but they failed to accomplish their goals. He added that the move has boomeranged, exacerbating the social and economic crisis across the West, especially in Europe.
American imperialism has never been very good at seeing two steps in front of itself. Due to the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia, they've actually hurt themselves equally, if not more, than they have Russia. Since these sanctions have been imposed on Russia, Russia has managed to earn over $100 billion in fossil fuel exports. The ruble has now bounced back to be 30% stronger than it was at the beginning of the year compared to the dollar. And these sanctions that America have imposed have caused a fuel crisis all over the world. This has caused huge problems as a detrimental effect on the agriculture of the world, which is now risking a food crisis.
In light of the West sanctions and the move backfiring, the US and many countries in Europe are experiencing record high inflations. Hence, the move has led to the average citizen paying the price of what Putin called decisions divorced from reality and taken contrary to common sense. Apart from inflations as high as 20%, the EU could also lose billions of dollars as a direct result of the sanctions. Moreover, the West policies and sanctions also seem to be responsible for worsening global food insecurity, as they're hindering many nations' attempts of helping those in need. In his speech, Putin noted that the sanctions on Russia, particularly those on fertilizer and grain, have stopped the country's exports and are one of the reasons for the global food insecurity. He also warned that if there is famine in the world's poorest countries, it will be entirely on the conscience of the US administration and the European bureaucracy. The US has so far led a foreign policy that is mainly comprised of hostile approaches against any nation that doesn't play by its rules. And the West not allowing for aid exports from Russia is only another example of its controversial policies. These hostile policies are clearly demonstrated by the US's rising tensions with China, which followed Washington's adventurism in Taiwan. Russia, which was faced with sanctions after Moscow followed the country's national interests, and Iran, which is subject to Washington's economic warfare. The US-led moves have, however, only resulted in target nations prospering and becoming stronger under the failed Western policies.
A new report by the Wall Street Journal reveals that Israel secretly coordinates with the U.S. on many of the airstrikes it carries out in Syria. The report adds that since 2017, Israel has carried out more than 400 airstrikes in Syria and other parts of the West Asia region. It claims that Israeli attacks have been aimed at restricting Iran and its allied forces in Syria. The vast majority of those Israeli airstrikes have been approved by the U.S. Central Command and at the Pentagon. The U.S. aims to ensure that Israel's bombing raids don't interfere with the U.S.-led military campaign in Syria. Many observers believe that the revelation by the Wall Street Journal was rather a confirmation of an open secret policy.
I think, first of all, whenever anyone says that the U.S. is secretly doing this or that with Israel, it's almost naive to say that. Israel is, in essence, an agent of the United States. I know there are people that think it works the other way around. But Israel is a Euro-American white settler state that was imposed on Palestine, as people know. Project beginning, I guess, perhaps you say, from the Balfour Declaration in the 20s forward to when the State of Israel, quote unquote, was created. And it's been a military base, basically, from which to secure the oil fields of the area, Iran's, Iraq's, all of it, Syria's, everywhere. The Israeli military, for all of its public relations effort to the contrary, is an agent of the U.S. military, with some nominal French and British input into that. Certainly financial input is not nominal, it's real. But this is a creature of the Pentagon and Langley that behaves in coordination with the policy that is implemented by the United States.
The timing of the Wall Street Journal revelation comes as the Israeli regime has increased its attacks against Syria. Last week, the regime heavily struck Damascus International Airport, which is still not completely up and running. Syrian officials have said on many occasions that U.S. troops in Syria are there to loot the country's resources. Former U.S. President Donald Trump was not embarrassed to frankly say that he kept U.S. troops in Syria for Syrian oil only.
We've kept the oil. We stayed back and kept the oil. Other people can patrol the border of Syria, frankly. And
the fight against Daesh seems to have been a good pretext to maintain U.S. illegal presence in Syria. Syrian officials have also repeatedly called on the United Nations to stop Israel's strikes on the country. But those calls have almost always gone unnoticed behind a couple of verbal admonitions by UN officials. This seems to have emboldened the regime to carry on its attacks with impunity.
After setting loose Daesh and Al-Qaeda and 47 other varieties of jihadi on Syria, the U.S. government found itself facing a request from the Syrian government that had, by the way, been twice elected since 2011 by vast majorities of Syrians inside and outside the country. Israel is, you know, a U.S. lapdog that has lots of advanced weapons. It's a money laundry for money that goes funneled through the Pentagon and Langley. Billions and billions of dollars of money taken from American taxpayers ends up in the hands of arms merchants, all kinds of people through Israel and whatever. And these things are used to inflict misery on the people of the Middle East to the extent that there's any resistance between these people that want to own the resources of that area and the actual ownership of it.
The confirmations of the U.S. approval and coordinations of Israeli attacks in Syria can definitely be seen as rather a public support for regime strikes in Syria, especially at a time when Israel has increased the intensity of its cross-border attacks. Such support would likely embolden the Israeli regime to carry out more attacks in Syria.
Turkey has targeted northern Iraq, killing several people and injuring a number of others. The strike hit the Sinjar Resisting Units, or YBS, a militia affiliated with the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, in Iraq's northern province of Sinjar. Turkey regards the PKK as a terrorist outfit. According to security sources, the strike hit a municipal council building in Snani, a village near the border with Syria. Turkey regularly carries out airstrikes into northern Iraq and has sent commandos to support its offensives. Baghdad accuses Turkey of violating its sovereignty. Turkey has a long-running military campaign in northern Syria against Syrian Kurdish YPG militia. Ankara considers that group as a terrorist organization as well. Ankara is reportedly planning to expand its military operation in northern Syria. President Erdogan has told the parliament Ankara aims to resume its efforts to create a 30-kilometer safe zone along its border with Syria. He has also urged NATO member states to support his country's efforts to establish a safe zone on the border with Syria.
It is crazy to think that the Turks will be fighting American-sponsored groups, and there isn't anybody in the world community that can call them up on the hypocrisy and say, you are fighting amongst yourselves in a way that could end up in a world war.
Turkey has deployed forces in Syria in violation of the Arab country's territorial integrity. The Syrian Foreign Ministry called on the international community not to work with Erdogan on the lands of other countries to achieve goals that will have catastrophic effects on security, peace, and stability in the region and in the world. Russia also considers Turkey's possible military operation in Syria unwise as it could escalate and destabilize the situation. Iran also voiced concern about the planned operation, saying the move could complicate the situation even further. In Syria, Turkey conducted three military operations in 2016, 2018, and 2019 that specifically aimed to prevent the formation of politically autonomous regions along the Turkish border controlled by Kurdish-dominated YPG militants. A fourth operation in 2020 in the Idlib region did not specifically target PKK affiliates, but it was in line with Turkey's desire to maintain territorial control and create a buffer zone along the Turkish-Syrian border.
But it's a big problem. It shows Turkey up for what it is, and that Turkey is doing everything in the region purely for their own short-term benefit, and they are quite happy to fight the Kurds and crush the Kurds, and this completely conflicts with the the Americans aren't really trying to help the Kurds, as they aren't ever really trying to help anyone apart from themselves, and their short-term allies, the Kurds, are going to end up fighting their other allies, the Turks.
Ankara-backed militants were deployed to northeastern Syria in October 2019 after Turkish military forces launched a long-threatened cross-border invasion in a declared attempt to push YPG fighters away from border areas. Turkey has played a major role in supporting terrorists in Syria ever since a major foreign-backed insurgency overtook the country more than 10 years ago. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and other senior officials have said the Damascus government will respond through all legitimate means available to the ongoing ground offensive by Turkish forces and allied Takfiri militants in the northern part of the war-battered Arab country.
Iran is expanding its diplomatic and economic ties with its neighbors and beyond. On Wednesday, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi hosted his Turkmen counterpart Serdar Berdimuhamedov in Saadabad Palace in northern Tehran. Iran and Turkmenistan signed a set of documents and memoranda of understanding to broaden bilateral cooperation in different fields. 9 MOUs were signed in the meeting to boost cooperation in various fields, including politics, economy, trade, transportation, investment, new technologies, environment, sports, energy, judiciary, education, research, and tourism. This is Berdimuhamedov's first visit to Iran as Turkmenistan's president. He traveled to Tehran in January as the special envoy of Turkmenistan's former president and held talks with Raisi. Iran and Turkmenistan have agreed to set up a major trade center that can facilitate ties between businesses in the two countries amid efforts to deepen economic relations between the two neighbors. The establishment of the Tehran-Ashgabat Trade Center was discussed on Tuesday during a meeting between Iranian Trade Minister Reza Fatemi Amin and Deputy Head of the Cabinet of Ministers of Turkmenistan, Batir Atayev. On Tuesday, Iran's president hosted visiting Pakistani Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari. During the meeting, Raisi hailed ties between Iran and Pakistan and said Tehran and Islamabad can expand their bilateral trade and business ties to benefit both nations.
I find this most recent flurry of diplomatic activity and state visits to Iran to be highly significant. What this signifies is that clearly Iran, far from being isolated on the world stage, is in fact extending its ties, bilateral ties, both regionally and as well ties to Venezuela in the Western Hemisphere.
And earlier in the week, Iran welcomed Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro and his high-level delegation. Iran and Venezuela have signed partnership agreements in the fields of science, technology, agriculture, oil and gas, petrochemicals, tourism, as well as culture. Raisi hailed the accord as an indication of the two countries' determination to expand bilateral ties despite U.S. and Western pressure. And the Venezuelan president, for his part, lauded the 20-year partnership agreement between Tehran and Caracas, saying the two sides will be able to expand bilateral relationship by consolidating their ties and drawing a clear vision in the next two decades.
As far as the outcome of these visits, this can only be positive for these nations, for most recently Pakistan, whose prime minister visited, for the Turkmen president, and as well for President Maduro. Those nations and national leadership that seeks to maintain sovereignty and independence, especially and particularly from American global economic and military hegemony, will greatly benefit their national economies as well as their populations.
And last month, Iran hosted Tajikistan's President Emomali Rahman. That visit also resulted in the signing of major deals between Tehran and Dushanbe. Since the inauguration of President Raisi's government, Tehran has stressed on the expansion of ties with regional as well as non-regional countries. Raisi's major achievement was his attendance at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in Dushanbe, where Iran was formally accepted as a new member of the organization. Iran's accession to the SCO will be a major boost to the bloc's influence in the region.
I believe what we're seeing is the relatively exciting and promising, although challenging, beginnings of the complete break from the dollar-based global economic system. I say exciting and promising because this will definitely enable nations that seek to maintain their independence and sovereignty to break from the dollar-based global economic system. However, this is certainly not an easy task and one that comes without costs.
Mainly because Iran's massive transportation network can facilitate regional and international trade. Iran is also expected to benefit economically from the membership in the bloc. The Iranian Customs Office said that Iranian exports to SCO members had increased by 41% year-on-year in the 11 months to late February, reaching nearly $18.3 billion.
But ultimately, we can look forward to the development of actual systems and structures that will enable nations, independent sovereign nations such as Iran, Russia, China, Venezuela, potentially other nations in the region who want to get on board, Turkmenistan, Pakistan, which we were recently talking about, to move towards a system that is not reliant, for example, on SWIFT and that completely bypasses the dollar.
Earlier this year, Iran's president also visited Russia to expand bilateral ties. Tehran and Moscow reached agreements to expand their cooperation in the fields of industry, defense and aerospace sectors, as well as oil and energy. The burgeoning ties between Iran and other countries have foiled plots by the US and its allies to isolate Iran. They also show that sanctions and threats have failed to stop Iran's progress.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.